This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pari Scott.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى مقومًا ولا أذًى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury, they shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
House of Representatives has voted to impeach President Donald Trump for the second time, making him the only U.S. president to be impeached twice. Iran slams the U.S. decision to label Yemen's Ansar Allah movement a terrorist organization. Also coming up, China reports its first coronavirus death in 8 months as investigators from the World Health Organization arrive in the city of Wuhan to probe the origin of the virus. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, the U.S. House of Representatives has voted to impeach President Donald Trump for the second time, making him the only U.S. president to be impeached twice.
On this vote, the ayes are 232, the nays are 197. The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
10 Republicans also voted for the motion. Trump was impeached over the charge of incitement of insurrection for his role in last week's deadly Capitol protests. The impeachment triggers a Senate trial just 1 week before Trump leaves office. Following the vote, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said there is no chance a fair and serious impeachment trial of Trump could conclude before President-elect Joe Biden is sworn in on January the 20th. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer said if Trump is convicted at the Senate impeachment trial, there will be a vote on barring him from running again for presidency. At a ceremony signing the article of impeachment, Nancy Pelosi once again slammed Trump.
Today, in a bipartisan way, the House demonstrated that no one is above the law, not even the President of the United States. That Donald Trump is a clear and present danger to our country, and that once again, we honor that oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States.
In his first comments after being impeached, Trump did not mention the House vote at all. In a video tape, the U.S. president urged Americans to be united and avoid violence. Trump said those who engaged in the attacks last week on the Capitol will be brought to justice. Similarly, in a statement, President-elect Biden did not take a stance on how the Senate should try Trump. He, however, urged the upper chamber
to address the priorities of his agenda, even as it deals with the impeachment. Political commentator Romero Funes says President Donald Trump's second impeachment will have serious implications for him, his party, and the U.S. itself.
The fact that Donald Trump is the first U.S. president to be impeached twice has some serious implications, not only for Trump himself, not only for the Republican Party, but for the United States as a whole. We've seen a lot of firsts throughout this presidential administration. This is one of the most divided times in the United States. Politically, polarization is at an all-time high. Political instability is becoming the norm in the United States, as well as government shutdowns. In 2020, we were very close to getting to a government shutdown. Tensions in the United States are going to continue getting worse as long as the crisis continues getting worse. People also have to remember that we're dealing with multiple crises at the same time. COVID-19 is destroying major cities in the United States, including Los Angeles, where I am now, New York, Washington, D.C. People are losing their jobs, businesses are shutting down. The economic, political, and financial crisis that is hitting the United States is something that Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, and the Democrats are not prepared at all to handle.
Author and journalist Daniel Lazar says the second impeachment of Donald Trump shows the United States is experiencing a deepening structural crisis.
The U.S. is entering into a period of growing instability for a variety of reasons. COVID-19 is out of control. Nearly 400,000 people have died. The American empire is in crisis. It's grossly overextended. 22 million jobs have disappeared since the lockdown. A massive housing crisis is looming. And now the political system itself, a 233-year-old political system, which has never been thoroughly revised, is now collapsing before our very eyes. And that's what this is about. This is about a deepening structural crisis where the two branches are at each other's throat. The parties are far apart. There's no opportunities for resolution. Things can only get worse and worse.
Meanwhile, security has been heightened across the U.S. Capitol as the House of Representatives pressed ahead with hearings on impeaching President Donald Trump. A tall metal fence was erected around the Congress building, which was blanketed with several layers of law enforcement personnel and extra security checks. Washington itself was in a state of high alert. Barricades were set up several blocks from the Capitol grounds, and thousands of armed National Guards lined the city's streets. This was in sharp contrast to security in the area last week when Trump's supporters stormed the Capitol. Amid fears of new violence, the Pentagon is deploying as many as 15,000 National Guard troops to protect President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration on January the 20th. Iran has warned that the U.S. designation of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement as a terrorist organization will hamper peace efforts in the country. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the blacklisting will also undermine the delivery of humanitarian aid to Yemen. Saeed Khatibzadeh said the outgoing Donald Trump administration is seeking to finish off its destructive role in Yemen's war and bring the political solution and peace talks in the Arab country to a deadlock. He pointed to the U.S. financial and military support for the Saudi-led coalition, saying Washington is the main accomplice to the crimes in Yemen. The UN has also warned about the serious humanitarian and political repercussions of the blacklisting. The move will come into effect on January the 19th, the Trump administration's last full day in office. The Iranian Navy is holding the second and final day of massive military exercises in the Sea of Oman. Iranian surface combat units, subsurface naval forces, as well as aerial units are practicing battles with mock enemy forces and are performing joint operations against any possible military scenario. Surface-to-surface cruise missiles and torpedoes will be fired from domestically developed submarines during the exercises. Unmanned aerial operations and electronic warfare tactics will be exercised as well. The drills are aimed at boosting the preparedness and military prowess of the country's armed forces in the strategic southern waters. Our correspondent Human Abidi had an interview with Rear Admiral Hamza Ali Kavayani, telling us about more about the second day of the naval drills.
In the course of these naval drills, I can mention three major points with respect to the drills. Firstly, the rapid reaction by the forces, including surface and subsurface units, and also land-to-sea missiles for implementing the plans that were not on the agenda. Because, as I said, the drills were not on the agenda. And the reaction by the forces have been quite rapid, covering a vast area of the land, 600,000 square kilometers, and the drills have rapidly expanded from the starting point. That's very important for us to have the rapid reaction in the face of threats. The other point is the presence of Fateh submarine, domestically manufactured submarine, and the launching of a torpedo, and hopefully today we'll have that implemented. And also the other point is the joining of two new units, the Zereh missile launcher vessel, and that joined the drills yesterday, and also the Macron helicopter carrier will be effective for supporting the naval units of the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran in covering the northern part of the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea, and the Gulf of Aden, and wherever it will be necessary for the Navy to carry out maritime operations. The helicopter carrier can support the naval units.
South Korea's apex court has upheld a 20-year prison term for former President Park Geun-hye over a corruption conviction. The ruling is final on an extended legal process, including a previous Supreme Court hearing. The court also upheld fines and forfeits totaling $19.5 million. Park Geun-hye was impeached in 2017 following mass protests against her. The following year, she was convicted of bribery and abuse of power and sentenced to 30 years in prison. Her sentence was later reduced to 20 years following her appeals and a retrial. The country's first female president has also separately been sentenced to 2 years in prison for election law violations. She now faces a total of 22 years behind bars. Let's get some more reaction to that story and bring in Jennifer Chang, our correspondent in the South Korean capital, Seoul. Jennifer, what's the latest you're hearing there in Seoul with regards to the court hearing and its aftermath?
Well, of course, the majority of South Koreans still oppose pardoning President Park. They still haven't forgiven her for all of her crimes, which ultimately led to her becoming the only South Korean president ever to be removed from office through the impeachment process back in 2017. Much of that had to do with not only her crimes, but also her hardline North Korea policy, which many South Koreans felt was going to bring on a possible second Korean War, which to South Koreans is unacceptable. They had to suffer the brunt of the casualties and deaths during the Korean War, especially the women and children. They were just such a shocking case to the whole world that so many civilians were dying in that war. And so they have vowed that they are never going to have another Second Korean War, no matter what, the majority of South Koreans. And of course, the current South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, upholds that policy of peace and engagement with North Korea to try to avoid a second Korean War, whereas President Park, when she was president, she was willing to actually conduct a preemptive strike militarily on North Korea if it was thought that the North would attack the South. So she had a variety of reasons why the South Korean public opposes her. And actually, right now, already people are closely watching who is going to be the next president of South Korea. And one of the front runners, Lee Nak-yeon, who heads the Democratic Party, which is the majority ruling party right now, he actually dropped out of favor from that lineup of possible presidential candidates because he favors a pardon of President Park Geun-hye, a total pardon. And many South Koreans are still adamantly opposed to that, especially within the Democratic Party itself. So he now is no longer one of the favored candidates, and there is just no way that the South Korean President Park Geun-hye, who used to be president but had to resign under such terrible circumstances and had to be ousted, actually, is going to ever become pardoned soon. She refused to actually admit any wrongdoing. She has never said that she did anything wrong, has never admitted to any of the charges against her, and she was forced out of office as a result.
Okay, Jennifer, thank you very much indeed for that. Jennifer Chang there, our correspondent, joining us from the South Korean capital, Seoul. Now, a team of international scientists led by the World Health Organization has arrived in the Chinese city of Wuhan to begin a probe into the origins of the coronavirus pandemic. Peter Ben Ambarak, leader of the team, said they would initially focus on advancing several studies and site visits. He, however, added that the investigation would take a long time. The arrival of the WHO experts coincides with China's announcement of its first COVID-related fatality in 8 months. The country has also recorded its highest daily cases in more than 5 months. China is grappling with a resurgence of the coronavirus amid strict lockdowns. A total of nearly 88,000 infections and over 4,600 related deaths have been reported there since the emergence of the virus in late 2019. Stephen Rebay says the WHO investigation into COVID-19 origins in China will be highly politicized.
The US under Trump, for example, has blamed China for not being transparent enough at the beginning of this pandemic and not doing enough to warn the rest of the world, which is a bit rich coming from Trump, who downplayed the threat right at the beginning. Of course, it's disappointing. This mission has been a long time coming. It was held up by China. And the WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus has said he actually criticized China. He said he was disappointed that they weren't given clearance to arrive earlier. I think it's because China's scared of this blame game, that the whole thing is going to be used as an exercise to blame China. It must be stressed that blame is going to do no good whatsoever. Everybody is hoping that the WHO scientists will be able to interview, be able to research, and find out where this virus came from in order to save the world from a future epidemic, maybe something which is much worse than this one.
Now, Britain has set a record high of nearly 1,600 COVID-19 deaths in one day as Europe keeps struggling with a second wave of the pandemic. The UK's infections also rose by over 47,000 to a total of 3.2 million. A steep rise in deaths and cases comes as the country is battling a new highly transmissible coronavirus variant. Meanwhile, Spain has reported 195 new deaths and nearly 39,000. More cases, marking its highest one-day increase in infections. Germany also registered over 19,000 new infections and over 1,000 deaths in 24 hours. The German health minister said the number of infections and deaths are soaring.
The numbers of infections and deaths are still too high, and we need to reduce them. Right now, in January 2021, we are experiencing a time of contrasts. In one hand, we are in one of the hardest phases of the pandemic. Behind the daily figures, there are tragedies, families who mourn. On the other hand, never before in human history was there a vaccine available so quickly against a new virus.
Spahn added that Germany will not be able to lift all restrictions next month. He also warned that the lockdown would need to be extended into February and perhaps beyond. Elsewhere in Europe, Italy registered 507 new deaths. Health authorities also confirmed over 15,000 new cases in the country. The surge in the spread of COVID-19 has prompted several countries to implement lockdown measures to curb the virus. The Portuguese Prime Minister says the country will return to a lockdown that was enforced in March and April last year to tackle a surge in coronavirus cases. Antonio Costa added that the restrictions will start on Friday, but schools will remain open during the lockdown. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
On Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. worship by which I may deserve thy plentiful reward, plenty in my state through lawful provision, and that thou makest me secure in the places of fear through thy security, and placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household, and make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Nolan was the driving force behind the 2014 insurrection that overthrew the Ukrainian government of Viktor Yanukovych in Ukraine and is now set to serve as Biden's Undersecretary for Political Affairs. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Alan McLeod Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "While railing against Trump coup, Biden appoints chief Ukraine coup plotter Victoria Nuland." Here's the details of this article. Describing it as one of the darkest days in American history, Joe Biden denounced Wednesday, January 6th, spectacular assault on the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., as a coup attempt fomented by Donald Trump. "I wish we could say we couldn't see it coming, but that isn't true. We could see it coming," the 78-year-old Delawarean said. "The last 4 years, we've had a president who's made his contempt for democracy, constitution, the rule of law clear in everything he has done. He unleashed an all-out assault on the institutions of our democracy from the outset. And yesterday was but a culmination of that attack. This is not dissent, it's disorder, it's chaos," he added, calling the events an unprecedented assault on the very fabric of U.S. democracy. Yet, almost at the same time as the future president was denouncing Trump's coup attempt, he was appointing Victoria Nuland, the driving force behind the 2014 insurrection that overthrew the Ukrainian government of Viktor Yanukovych, as his new Undersecretary for Political Affairs. The United States and NATO had been making overtures to Ukraine for some time before the coup, hoping that the country would become the latest post-Soviet state to fall into their fold as they continued to expand eastwards. Yanukovych, however, was in favor of steering Ukraine in a more Russia-friendly direction. The decision spared demonstrations across the country from pro-EU forces. The Obama administration immediately sensed an opportunity, sending Nuland across the world to lead and support the movement, the senior diplomat rallying protesters, and was even photographed handing out cookies in the streets. While in the West, the revolt was presented as being led by tech-savvy, forward-thinking students. In reality, most of the muscle was supplied by neo-Nazi militias who helped force through Yanukovych's downfall and continue to hold an oversized role in Ukrainian politics and society. In December, the United States and Ukraine were the only two nations to vote against a United Nations measure combating glorification of Nazism, neo-Nazism, and other practices that contribute to fueling contemporary forms of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerance. This was done as they felt the resolution could be used to target the Ukrainian government and the U.S. continued funding of it. Leaked phone calls show that Nuland, an American ambassador to Ukraine, Geoffrey Piat, had long conversations about who should make up the post-coup government. The events of early 2014 spooked Russia so badly that it flew troops into Crimea to annex the territory. The affair led to increasing tensions between the US, Ukraine, and Russia, and almost led to a hot war between the two nuclear-armed countries. In the end, President Obama refused to escalate tensions, and to the point angering many in Washington. Among them seemingly was Nuland, who promises to again be a Russia hawk. As Politico wrote recently, she has been an outspoken critic of President Donald Trump's foreign policy, particularly his appeasement of Russian President Vladimir Putin. In reality, however, Trump was extremely bellicose with Moscow, sanctioning the country, bombing a Russian base in Syria, and letting a number of anti-nuclear treaties expire, much to the Kremlin's consternation. While Vice President Biden's administration also oversaw the 2009 overthrow of the democratically elected president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya, aiding in his ouster and replacement with a brutal military dictatorship that continues to rule the country to this day. In her memoir, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton boasted that she helped render the question of Zelaya moot. She did so by blocking action from regional bodies like the Organization of American States. Wednesday, January 6th events also resemble a number of other U.S. planned coup d'etats, including that of Venezuela in 2002. With help from the American Embassy in Caracas, right-wing and far-right forces marched on the Miraflores Presidential Palace, joining up with sympathetic military units to storm the building and capture President Hugo Chavez. In the melee, dozens of people were killed and Chavez was overthrown, replaced by a well-known businessman with no political experience. The White House immediately welcomed what it euphemistically called a change in the government. 2 days later, the coup was reversed by a huge popular uprising. In 2018, Mint Press reported that many American far-right and white nationalist groups were receiving training from precisely the same Ukrainian neo-Nazis that the U.S. government had tutored. Those far-right groups were out in force at the Unite the Rally in Charlottesville, VA in 2017, where they killed a counter-protester. Thus, it is eminently possible that many of those storming the Capitol building on Wednesday, January 6th, were taught insurrectionary tactics from individuals trained to do so on behalf of the U.S. empire abroad. a classic case of blowback and an event that allows Americans to experience a tiny taste of what it has wrought on the world for several decades.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Hello everyone, my name is Amina Taylor and we're broadcasting from the British capital and we begin this broadcast with our top story. Now, the House of Representatives is expected to hold a vote on impeaching U.S. President Donald Trump a little bit later, as Democrats and several Republican politicians accuse the U.S. President of encouraging his supporters to storm the U.S. Capitol building in an attack that so far left five dead. President Trump has dismissed the accusations, labeling them ridiculous, and stated that his speech before last week's Capitol Hill riots was, quote, totally appropriate. The news comes just a day after Vice President Mike Pence rejected the Democrats' bill to invoke the 25th Amendment, which would force the U.S. president from office. Meanwhile, tough security measures are being put in place across Washington, D.C., ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's 20th of January inauguration, including the placement of anti-climb fences around the Capitol building. This just days after authorities revealed that there could be three separate plots to attack the Capitol ahead of the inauguration. Well, Kirst Banbury, the author and political commentator, joins us now for his take on this developing story. Are we going to see history being made by Donald Trump here, but perhaps, Chris, not the history he would have liked?
Well, I think it's going to be a bit more long haul than that. Firstly, the House of Representatives has to vote in favor of his amendments. Then it has to go to the Senate. For the Senate to initiate impeachment, it needs a two-thirds majority. Now, there's talk of leaving that vote in the Senate till the 19th of January, when the new Senate, which has a very, well, not it, it's 50-50, but it gives the Democrats more hope. But a two-thirds majority, I mean, the Democrats basically have 50%, rely on the casting votes of the Speaker, to get another, that requires a big tranche of Republican votes. And we're seeing some Republicans, yes, coming over to say they now support impeachment, but it would take a big number of Republicans to do that. The second factor in it as well is whether or not Joe Biden wants this to happen prior to his inauguration as president. Remember, Biden's priority is to show that he is the voice of mainstream America, the champion of democracy, etc. And in many ways, his priority is making sure he gets into the White House, he gets his team around him. That's what he's focused on. So maybe it's in his interest as well for this to be the way. So technically, Trump has left office on the 20th of January. He can still be impeached, though. Still be impeached even after he's left office.
Well, some would have said horse bolted gates, perhaps in that order. But are we looking here at a smooth transition of power? Because so far, Chris, I mean, things are a little dicey right now.
I think we will see a smooth transition now. I think you have to remember the American elite and the American establishment and the people who make up the American state, I mean, are very determined to achieve this. What we saw in those scenes with the storming of Congress was humiliating for America, and it will be used by its opponents around the world to point to the failures of American democracy. So they all been working really hard to try and make sure that this machinery now goes into place and we have a transition. The big question is, what is going to happen now in terms of the Republican Party? Is there going to be a fracture between those people who are denouncing Trump and Trump and his supporters? And are we going to see what till now has been a disparate far right in the United States, which hasn't really managed to get its act together? Is that possible now in the United States? Could a far right emerge as it has done across the Atlantic in much of Europe? These are interesting questions.
And very briefly, you touched on it there, Chris, the idea that Trump may be leaving, kicking or screaming, albeit, but Trumpism might be having a second win.
I think Trumpism, that is the real question. I fear that, you know, as I say, these groups have been very disparate groups. They're fairly bonkers, fairly bad in many respects as well. But clearly, around issues of Islamophobia, about racism, around issues about democracy itself, there is the ground there for a ground on which a far-right organization could emerge. Now, what's Trump going to do? Is he just going to go quietly into the night? Even if he's in the process of being impeached, he's not far from office, as I understand it. So it's possible Trump, and there are others as well, who, I mean, Rudy Giuliani, etc., who could emerge and see their chance as being given the focus to pull that far right together in the United States. That is going to be really a question. Can the far right build on what they've done so far in the United States?
Indeed. Chris Bambury, thank you. Watching that situation closely, of course. To some other news now, the Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Mark Rutte, announced his country will be extended its COVID-19 lockdown by a further 3 weeks until February as the nation battles soaring infection rates. Under the new restrictions, the toughest yet imposed, schools and non-essential businesses will be closed, and people are being banned from having more than two additional people inside their homes. Earlier in the week, the country's health minister, Hugo de Jong, noted special concern for the British variant of the virus that is thought to be making up between 2 and 5% of Dutch infections. The Netherlands currently has some 883,000 confirmed cases, with just over 12,500 deaths. People in central Spain are struggling to cope in the aftermath of last weekend's heavy snowfall, which has now turned to ice and made roads and street safety hazardous. Temperatures plummeted to a record low of some minus 25.4 degrees Celsius in the town of Bayo, located in the east of Madrid. At least 7 people have died due to the inclement weather so far. Schools remain closed in the capital and much of central Spain, with emergency and military crews still working to reopen roads and distribute food and the coronavirus vaccine. The historic snowfall comes at a time when Spain continues to be battered by soaring COVID-19 rates. The country so far has registered 2 million confirmed cases, with nearly 52,000 deaths. Kasai Kedrip in Barcelona joins us now. Kasai, good to see that you're nice and cozy looking there at least. Is the weather affecting this fight against COVID, and how so?
Sure it does, Alina. The latest snowstorm did impact Spaniards in their daily lives in the sense that it did disrupt the traffic, and it also slowed down the movement of vaccines across the 17 regions, so much so that the central government was forced to deploy special convoys to keep the foodstuff moving between the regions and particularly ensure that the vaccines reach the 17 autonomous regions. It had to rely on the military to do so. And as you see on your screen, pictures there, the snow has hampered mainly the center of Spain, the capital. Here in Barcelona, there was no snow, and that difference is also impacting the reality of COVID. I live in Barcelona, so I live in Catalonia, not in Madrid, and that that also is a different reality from Madrid. Here, there is cautious optimism as to the COVID-19 policy of the regional government. The restrictions are less tough than in other regions. Many of the 17 regions are stepping up restrictions ahead of the of what they consider as the upcoming third wave of the coronavirus. Here in Catalonia, there is cautious optimism. The health experts say there is no need for now to impose a total lockdown on the region, but they consider they definitely consider more restrictions in the weeks ahead. One major decision that they will have to take on Friday is whether to cancel an upcoming regional election slated for mid-February. Otherwise, the vaccination is very slow in Spain, as you know, yes, due to disruptions and a lack of supply with regard to the Pfizer and BioNTech vaccine. Today, Spain has received the first supply of Moderna vaccine. So that increases the chances that they that it would reach the general public, but the government had to walk back its optimistic forecast of vaccinating and immunizing 70% of the population by the end of the summer. Now they are saying that this will not happen before 2022.
Well, we know all about broken promises here as it pertains to the vaccine. Good to see you, Kusai. Thank you very much. Now we move now to Turkey and Greece, because those countries have set a date for talks that might break a five-year impasse over maritime boundaries and offshore energy resources. The EU has firmly taken the side of Athens in this dispute, drawing up a list of sanctions against Turkey, a move Ankara has labeled strategic blindness. Bianca Rahimi has more in this report.
Turkey has the longest continental coastline in the eastern Mediterranean and rejects the maritime boundary claims of Greece and the Greek Cypriot administration in the region. Ankara says these claims are excessive and violate the sovereign rights of both Turkey and Turkish Cypriots. The EU decided on punitive measures against Turkey last year after Ankara asserted its rights in the region by sending several drill ships to explore for energy on its continental shelf. However, the implementation of sanctions has been postponed until March, and Turkey says it is ready to get its relationship with the EU back on track in 2021.
We are inviting Greece, which has been increasing its airspace violations and unlawful activities in islands that are demilitarized, to give up their actions that are raising tensions. I believe that the exploratory talks with our neighbor Greece, which will start on the 25th of January, will, God willing, herald a new period.
European diplomats have signaled the dispute between Turkey and Greece is of paramount importance, and also that progress has already been made.
What I have felt from my discussion with the minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu is progress has been made too, both in the way of relations between Turkey and Greece and in relations between Turkey and Cyprus and in relations between Turkey and France, to give you some examples.
Another issue high on the agenda for talks is Turkey's EU membership bid. Negotiations began in 2005, but have since come to a standstill. Erdogan says Turkey's membership will be a good thing for the EU, now Britain has left the bloc.
Uncertainties that are increasing with Brexit can only be dissipated with Turkey receiving its rightful place in the European family. We, as a country, are ready to put our relations back on track and create positive agendas with a long-term perspective.
In recent talks, Turkey has been quick to remind the EU of its dependence on Ankara when it comes to preventing hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants from trying to cross into European nations. Turkey says by taking initiatives in places like Syria and Libya, it is contributing to the EU's security considerably and is calling on the bloc not to allow disputes with individual members like Greece and France to jeopardize that. Bianca Rahimi, London.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Robert Carter, it seems Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's making some, well, quite damning accusations about, wait for it, Iran and al-Qaeda. Are we talking here about woeful ignorance or willful propaganda?
Well, I can tell you exactly how the Iranians have responded to the claim. They've called it absolutely preposterous, Amina. And I have to say I agree with them, as does many other experts in the field. Anyone who knows anything about Iran or al-Qaeda will know that these are lifelong enemies. Iran has played a key role in battling al-Qaeda and defeating them on several fronts over the past sort of 10 years or so. We're talking about in Iraq, Syria, and elsewhere, even in Lebanon, they've supported the fight against these radical Takfiri groups, yet for some reason and without any solid evidence to back up his claim, the US's Mike Pompeo has just thrown this accusation out there, and it's gone down very badly, both on social media and in the press. I actually have a clip which demonstrates Pompeo's accusation. Let's play that out now.
Al-Qaeda has a new home base. It is the Islamic Republic of Iran. As a result, bin Laden's wicked creation is poised to gain strength and capabilities.
Did you know Iran was on the grassy knoll when Kennedy was shot?
Well, that's just one of the accusations which people have been bringing up sarcastically, so linking Iran to basically anything they want, given that Pompeo's doing exactly the same. People have been doing it online as well, just for a laugh, to kind of highlight the sheer hypocrisy and the joke behind these comments. I also have an old news article which portrays the founder of al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, in very favorable terms. And this was written back in the time when Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen active in Afghanistan were supported by the US and were financed and supplied with arms to fight against the Soviet Union. So for Pompeo to claim that Iran is somehow best friends with al-Qaeda, when actually, historically speaking, it was Washington who was rubbing shoulders with Osama bin Laden and so on, is an absolutely outrageous claim and a total joke, as we've realized. And that has been reflected on social media as well. I have two tweets which I think sum up this story very well, Amina. I'll go straight to the first. It's from Hadi Nasrallah, who says very straightforwardly, the U.S. armed al-Qaeda in Syria. Israel, a vital U.S. ally, backed al-Qaeda as well. Saudi Arabia and Qatar, both U.S. client states, funded al-Qaeda. But according to Pompeo, Iran is al-Qaeda's new home. Are you kidding me? And then the second tweet I have from Assad here on the same line, saying that he added that Iran is also the new base of communism, jokingly, Nazism, and any ideology that the West ever abhorred. But Pompeo denied that he coordinated his discoveries with the head of Mossad, with whom he met yesterday. So the first part of the tweet, just taking a little joke, a little jab at Pompeo there. But the second line was actually based on some truth. Pompeo
deadly
coordinating
serious
with
there,
Mossad.
Rob. And something else that could be quite serious if you value your privacy. Your next story.
Yes, so moving on now. The free communication app, WhatsApp, has come under criticism and appears to have a mass exodus taking place as we speak after announcing new privacy policies that it's going to force on its members. And this, of course, has raised many questions about how secure are you on this WhatsApp network, and are they snooping in on your private chats and that sort of thing. So obviously people are turning to alternatives, other apps being downloaded instead, and WhatsApp has been forced to try and essentially do damage control to try and stop so many people leaving their service. WhatsApp, of course, owned by Facebook as well, which we know is a politicized social media platform which gags free speech for any group or individual that speaks out against Western US foreign policy, for example. The Palestinian cause, Iranian voices are being censored, and so many people fear that WhatsApp will just be an extension of that. And this, of course, is reflected on social media. I can go to the first tweet, which is from Will Cathcart, who actually represents WhatsApp and works for WhatsApp. He says, with end-to-end encryption, we cannot see your private chats or calls, and neither can Facebook. We're committed to this technology and committed to defending it globally, so trying to defend, do damage control there. However, criticism coming in thick and fast on social media. Ankit, who says, here is a clarification sent out by WhatsApp on the latest privacy concerns. However, in my experience, it is not entirely true. Each time I chat with a new person on WhatsApp, they are shown on my friend's suggestion on Facebook. Very suspicious. And Pratik has come out with a new viewpoint here, saying that WhatsApp is attempting to change the very basic definition of privacy. Since when is an individual's conversation with a business not private? If I go to a store and buy a product, is that supposed to be private information? Don't fall for the claptrap. So essentially saying that it'll probably blow over and it's not so serious, but many people disagreeing there. This is taken
indeed, nothing
very
is free. No such thing as a free lunch or a free app. Thank you, Robert Carter. Right, so Ireland's Prime Minister has said he would issue a formal state apology in Parliament after an inquiry found widespread mistreatment of women and children at so-called mother and baby homes. This is where thousands of infants died and were sometimes buried in mass graves. For most of the 20th century, these homes housed orphans, unmarried pregnant women and their babies. Often the cultural shame meant that the level of care fell below expectations.
The report describes a dark, difficult and shameful chapter of very recent Irish history, and a history that has had a very real and lasting consequences for many people. It holds up a mirror to aspects of our past which are painful and difficult, and from the present-day perspective, often hard to comprehend.
The inquiry is part of a process of reckoning in the overwhelmingly Roman Catholic country to try and come to terms with a history of abuse in church-run institutions, including the shunning and shaming of unwed mothers, many of whom were pressured into giving up their babies for adoption. Perhaps, Robert Inlakesh, we should rename this the Pompeo half an hour, because there's more misdirection from the Secretary of State, in this case, Cuba.
Absolutely. A lot of people have been replying to what Mike Pompeo had stated online just around a day ago, now that the United States would reinstate Cuba on the state sponsors of terrorism list, which would, of course, pave way for more sanctions on Cuba. The U.S. Trump administration has, however, sanctioned Cuba despite this, the fact that they were taken off the list 5 years ago by the Obama administration. And, of course, under the Obama administration, there was a push to try and mend ties with Cuba, the former Soviet-backed adversary. Of course, we know about the Cuban Missile Crisis and what transpired there between the United States and Cuba. But now, under Trump, we've seen with this push to try and get rid of Nicolas Maduro as the president of Venezuela, and the fact that Cuba has been backing Venezuela, that this is really a reaction to that and their failed attempt at a coup inside of Venezuela. A video that I released a few hours earlier by Mike Pompeo on his Twitter account.
We must defend unalienable rights today,
because the international human rights project is in crisis. Authoritarian governments, from China to Iran to Venezuela, are depriving our fellow human beings of their basic rights. Meanwhile, many multinational organizations have lost their way, focusing on partisan policy preferences while failing to defend fundamental rights.
And this is while his very own political allies decide whether to impeach his boss. He says that line without a shred of irony. What's been the social media reaction, Rob? Because I can't actually believe he said these things with a straight face.
Well, lots of social media reaction to the tweet which he released just 4 hours after that video, stating that they would transfer Cuba, redesignate Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism, hence punish the people of Cuba. It's never about punishing governments, it's about punishing people. We've got the first one here from the head of Code Pink, Medea Benjamin, who says, "Disgusting hypocrites, Cuba is saving lives around the world with its medical missions. The U.S. is killing people with bombs. Who is the terrorist?" We've got another one here from a user called Sage, who says, "Trying to create alternative terrorism news to distract from the fact that your deplorable orange boss is being impeached for inciting terrorist murders."
Wow. I guess very briefly here, Robert, this is Mike Pompeo going out with a bang.
Absolutely, and it seems that Trump is going down a hardline neocon path, even to the very last day at the 11th hour, issuing orders like this. We saw the registration of Ansar Allah as a terrorist organization, which will lead to an escalation of violence
Indeed.
Inside of Yemen and everything else
he's been doing. So much pain, so much sorrow, so little time, and that is where we leave both.